All right, and we should be good to go.
Well, good evening and good afternoon to those of you on the East and West Coast. My name is Eric, and I'm joined by my colleagues Aaron and Eric. And on behalf of us and the American Herbalist Guild, I'd like to welcome all of you to the first webinar of the 2012 series. We're all humbled and honored to be here with you in this capacity, and we hope you'll enjoy the ancient threads of our craft that we've teased out and woven together to tell this story. And just a side note to keep the name straight, I do go by Mickey. Aaron goes by Ari.
Hi.
Eric, as the elder, gets to keep his name. So.
Thanks, Mickey.
All right, so.
Before we jump in, we want to make the point that, like this famous poem, what we're doing here is not an attempt at an encyclopedic or exhaustive history of our tradition. We only have 90 minutes, and there are plenty of things we'll fail to mention within that span of time that probably merit their own dialogue.
More to the point, this presentation is an effort to illustrate some of the patterns that exist within the development of our collective consciousness, both as a species and as professionals, those that shape our present-day circumstances, and some of the decisions that face us as we move forward into a future that is far more unknowable than our past. But we must remember not to let the shadows of that past eclipse the brightness of our potential future. As you're all probably familiar with, this is the premise of our presentation.
Throughout the written history of the West, the apothecary has long filled an essential role for the community. Refined for the Western mind during the Renaissance, the apothecary was effectively disconnected from the rich heritage tediously developed by generations of dedicated practitioners who prepared and parceled botanical medicines.
As herbal medicine once again moves to the forefront of our national consciousness, more of our friends and neighbors visit their local clinical herbalist for support. As the demand for mindful health care grows, it is essential that we rediscover our longstanding traditions and their relevance to a viable clinical practice. This first section is entitled A Tradition of Elders, the Bond Between People and Plants.
Herbalists are people who dedicate their lives to working with medicinal plants. While herbalists are quite varied, the common love and respect for life, especially the relationship between plants and humans, unites them.
This relationship between people and plants really defines the scope of the herbalist. And in some ways, it drives the existence of our species. This association is longstanding and predates much of what we can really know about ourselves with conviction. However, I imagine few would argue with any real success that primitive man would have arisen through the ages without the unending benevolence of plants as food, clothing, medicine, shelter, vessels, and more. Throughout the millennia, we've developed a profoundly symbiotic relationship that provides a traceable thread throughout the development of both our species.
Our story begins 60,000 years ago at a gravesite known today as the Shenandoah Cave, located in present-day Iraq. The soil around the grave was characterized by the scientists who analyzed it as thickly scattered with pollen grains from 8 different genus of plant, 7 of which are medicinal herbs of antiquity. Some are even prominent among contemporary materia medica, including the herbs Althea, Muscari, Achillea, and Ephedra. While we can't say for certain these plants were used medically by our Paleolithic ancestors, we can say that the relationship certainly evolved to that point, as virtually every known culture practices some form of plant-based medicine.
In Egypt, we're blessed to find some of the oldest existing records of the evolving relationship between plants and humans, and as a result, the ancient foundations of our profession. In a book titled Plant Hunters, the author Tyler Whittle suggests that as man grew in sophistication, his need to douse bad smells and flavors was met by merchants who traded in spices over the ancient caravan routes. He points out that in 2500 BC, an Egyptian pharaoh sent an envoy south to the Red Sea on a search for prepared herbs and spices. And that by 1500 BC, we see fairly detailed accounts of the caravans that traveled from and throughout Egypt.
We know that in 1500 BC, Queen Hatshepsut commissioned the first recorded wildcrafting expedition. Motivated by a desire for the resin of Boswellia, she sent 5 ships to the land of Punt, which are the shores of modern-day East Africa, where it was known to grow wild. The ships returned with a quantity of seeds and live plants, and 31 of the trees were successfully established at the Queen's Royal Gardens in Karnak, where an official record was carved into the walls to record the success of the expedition. As Whittle points out, it's somewhat difficult to appreciate, but important to note, that this first recorded plant hunting expedition took place when Athens, Rome, Paris, and London were non-existent. We can't talk about any aspect of Western history, not to mention the development of medicine, without touching on the Greeks and the Romans. There are many renowned figures from antiquity that hail from these ancient lands, who are credited with seminal contributions to the development of an organized system of medicine in the West. Aristotle, Hippocrates, Galen, Dioscorides, and Pliny the Elder are a few that come to mind.
Another significant influence of the Greek and Roman culture on the development of the relationship between people and plants, you know, aside from the loosely connected foundations that were introduced by these philosophers, naturalists, and physicians, were the ongoing campaigns of endless war. In this near constant rushing of cultures, seeds and knowledge were exchanged freely amongst physicians on campaign, and numerous species of plants were transported throughout the known world. I mean, the wealth of information accessible to the army physics is clearly evident in Dioscorides' De Materia Medica, a tome that has remained a noteworthy text to this day. Dr. Garneau, I'm sure you can speak.
Yeah, I was just going to expound on that a little bit further. That Dioscorides' work is, of course, very famous and really was the textbook of herbal medicine for almost 2,000 years. Everyone went to it as the source, and it's a very interesting document. He, besides providing botanical descriptions, many of which you would recognize today, I was just looking at the one for Chelidonium today, and everyone here, I think, who's ever met that plant would instantly recognize his description, even though he was not, you know, botany did not exist per se. So he was both a botanist, so to speak, and he was, of course, a wildcrafter because he had to find a lot of the medicine that he used, sort of as illustrated here, along the way as the armies were moving around and he was treating the soldiers, as well as being an actual clinician and both gathering information from local sources when he didn't know the plants where they were or using his own accumulated knowledge. And we're just really lucky he set that down. I would also like to point out that his Materia Medica is quite distinct from most others in that it was arranged by the utility of plants and by their actions. It was not an alphabetical listing. And that really points to the fact that this was a working text meant for people to use, and that Dioscorides himself used, and that his accounts are based on firsthand practical knowledge and not theory or basically going only from other sources, which many other Materia Medicas of the time suffer from that problem. So it's a great work. There are several translations available, and I recommend people use that even today. And so we'll move on to the next.
In Green Pharmacy, Barbara Griggs lays out an exhaustive evolution of Western herbal medicine. In it, she points out that soldiers of all nationalities, as well as common sailors, merchants, and other travelers, carried plants from place to place either because they were beautiful, good to eat, or useful as medicine. Rudimentary physic gardens sprang up near Roman camps. No Roman quartermaster, for instance, could have envisaged any campaign without huge supplies of garlic.
The Romans' legion spread throughout Europe created a vast network of exchange. Dr. Arnell highlighted that with Dioscorides' Materia Medica. Griggs points it out in her book. The results of which are fundamental dynamics in Western culture. Without the widespread dispersion of these Mediterranean herbs and the shared medicinal knowledge of Greek and Roman armies, might contemporary materia medica of the Western herbalists be different? As the Roman Empire recedes in the 5th century, we begin to see Arabic influences fill up the void. Up until the 7th century, there are relatively few prominent physicians from the Arabic world. However, this is quick to change as Muslim armies overrun North Africa and bringing Islam to the Mediterranean world. In the process, they collect a trove of Greek and Roman medical texts, and the Abbasid caliphs play a critical role in nurturing the continued development of medicine. Under their leadership, the major works of Dioscorides, Hippocrates, among others, are stored in the House of Wisdom, which is pictured here, and translated into Arabic by Hunayn bin Ashwal al-Ibadi, who lived in 1809 to 1873.
The first work translated was that of Hippocrates, so his philosophies had a widespread influence on the Muslim mind. Teaching hospitals featured prominently in cities throughout the Muslim Empire and emphasized focused and structured clinical practice. Studies in public health and preventative medicine began in earnest and characterized the works of physicians like Al-Razi and Ibn Sina, better known to us Westerners as Avicenna.
Simultaneously influenced greatly by Dioscorides' texts and his systematic approach and the tenets of their faith, Muslims classified a materia medica that encompassed hundreds of medicinal plants already known in pre-Islamic Arabia or imported from Persia, India, the Far East along the great trade routes. Muslim faith thought that plants were a manifestation of God's wisdom, provided for man's ailments, to be naturally sourced as needed. And this insight fostered an active investigation into medicinal plants. And by 1800 AD, pharmacy has been well established as a separate profession from clinical medical practice. Back to the future. The apothecary is born in Europe.
Constantine the African, a Muslim scholar from Tunisia, brings our story back to Europe in the 11th century. Constantine translates key Arabic medical texts into Latin for the first time at the medical school in Salerno. One version of how Constantine fell into this circumstance holds that he became ill in Salerno while traveling as a trader. A physician was called to Constantine's bedside. However, when the physician attempted to prescribe a cure for Constantine without so much as inspecting his urine, Constantine was horrified. He concluded that Europe must only possess a limited scope of simple medicines and decided he must come to their aid. In any case, for the first time, the Europeans have synthesized the works of the Greek and Roman texts, colored by massive contributions of the Muslim world.
The Arabic texts favored complex compounding, with the addition of corrigents and flavor enhancers. The Arabs also introduced purgatives to the European materia medica. Cassia Senna is one that springs to mind. Today, we refer to this respective tradition as Unani Tib. With the addition of the Arabic models, the theory and praxis of Europe's medical landscape really begins to transform. For example, Serapio's work, which was written around the 11th century, sorted and classified the hundreds of new plants the Arabs introduced to the West based on Galenic categories, which later Western physicians generally regarded as practical, and their apothecaries regarded as invaluable. In medieval Europe, we see here on this slide, individuals selling wine, spices, and herbs were known as apothecaries. They prepared and sold medicines to physicians and directly to patients. In addition, they offered medical advice and other products. From the 13th century, apothecaries are starting to establish guilds across Europe, sometimes jointly with physicians and sometimes with merchants and traders of spice and wares.
By 1180, the apothecaries of that time began to get organized. Initially, they were part of the Guild of Pepperers. In 1316, the little mentioned Guild of Spicers joined the Pepperers, growing their ranks. Pepperers later became wholesale merchants. In that time, they were termed dealing in gross, which soon became the word grocer. In 1428, the Pepperers are incorporated as the Worshipful Company of the Grocers. Originally part of the grocery business, the Society of Apothecaries was established in its own right in 1617.
So the London apothecaries, with their specialist pharmacy skills that have been influenced as we've detailed, petitioned for several years to secede from the grocer's company. Gideon de Leu, and I'm sorry if my French is not very accurate, was a wealthy and influential Huguenot, and he led the separatists. He was the apothecary to Anne of Denmark, who was the wife of King James I, which may have helped them gain the king's approval. The Worshipful Society of Apothecaries of London was incorporated by royal charter on the 6th of December in 1617.
Later, when King James in the House of Commons was asked about his decision to allow the apothecaries to separate, he stated, "I myself did devise that corporation and do allow it. The grocers who complain of it are but merchants. The mysteries of these apothecaries were belonging to apothecaries, wherein the grocers are unskilled, and therefore I think it is fitting they should be a corporation unto themselves."
So from 1672 until 1922, the Society of Apothecaries manufactures and sells medicinal and pharmaceutical products at the Apothecaries Hall. Pictured here is the coat of arms above the entryway in that hall. And as you can see, the guild motto reads, "I am called the bringer of health throughout the world." In 1673, the Society of Apothecaries founded the Chelsea Physic Garden.
So, as we said, in 1673, in July, the Society took a lease on 3.5 acres of land on the riverfront of Chelsea, where they built a house and proceeded to cultivate a physic garden for well over 2 centuries. The apothecaries' apprentices and later medical students were taught botany and materia medica within the grounds.
So an informed knowledge of botany was an essential part of the apothecary's practice. And it had been promoted by a group of botanist apothecaries led by Johns Parkinson, who was a founding member of the society, and his colleague Thomas Johnson. Until the mid-19th century, most medicines were derived from herbs, plants, and vegetables. The physic garden thus served as a place of instruction, and in addition providing simples and raw materials for the manufacture of drugs in the laboratory at the Apothecary's Hall.
Apothecaries of this time frequently flouted the authority of the physicians by dispensing medicines without prescription. The Society and the College of Physicians were at bitter variance over these issues for many years until a test case went to appeal in the House of Lords in 1704.
William Rose, a freeman of the Society, was prosecuted by the physicians for visiting a sick man in his home, prescribing medicines for him, and dispensing them. But bowing to recognize common practice, the Lords actually ruled in favor of the apothecary, for physicians were relatively few in number, and most could not afford their fees. This meant that the apothecaries could both prescribe and dispense meds.
The College of Physicians, fairly angered by this act, countered by asserting their right to inspect apothecaries' shops by imposing stringent controls on raw drugs and medicinal preparations. Medical reform and regulated profession, especially with regard to education, became a major concern at the close of the 18th century. Members of the society were at the forefront of the movement which gathered momentum between 1810 and 1814 and resulted in the Apothecaries Act of 1815.
Essentially, in the apothecary is legally defined, for the, as we see here, a mere reader of simples and the unpaid compounder of a physician's prescription. Darnell, any comment on the mere tailor of simples and the unpaid compounder of a physician's prescription?
Blatant power grab. Look at how history repeats itself today. We see the same thing.
Yeah, so in actual, there was a movement headed by the College of Physicians that actually inserted the particular wording we see on the second part of the slide into the act that reads, it is the duty of a person using or exercising the art and mystery of the apothecary to prepare with exactness and to dispense such medicines may be directed for the sick by any physician lawfully licensed.
However, this act also granted apothecaries the right to license and qualify practitioners. In England, this is actually the origins of the general practitioner. The act also gave statutory sanction to the society to examine and certify those that dispensed compounds. So, we then see attendance at lectures and botany cease to be a part of the medical curriculum following the Medical Act of 1886. Botany as a subject of examination was soon discontinued by resolution of the Society's Court of Examiners in 1894.
In this social current, we begin to see the modern perception of botanicals being separated from drugs relegating to the realm of the physician, and botanicals really going back to the folk healer and back to the kitchen. Dr. Yarnell, were there any closing comments that you'd wish to make on that period of history?
I just want to comment that the word drug means dried herb. That's a Dutch/German, old German word. Word drug is our word.
It's interesting. In our research, we actually found that dating way back into prehistorical Germanic languages, drogi, as I could most accurately pronounce it, actually means dry and only dry. And somewhere in the Middle Germanic languages, there's a mistranslation. And drogi is used to reference the contents of these barrels that contain dried herbs. And then we see in Middle English suddenly drogi popping up to mean drug, as Dr. Yarnell points out. So moving on into the New World, herbs in the colonies through modern American herbalism.
First, when the Europeans came to North America, they brought their herbs with them, but one of the things that's often overlooked is that they were very actively seeking other plants. You know, famously, Columbus was trying to better route to India for the purpose of the spice trade, but as discovered there was this other continent there, you know, despite all the other bad things that happened, one of the things was an immediate and immense trade in herbs. Allspice was a very early one that was transported from Central America and the Caribbean back to the Old World. But the European plants were introduced quite intentionally, and the I particularly wanted to mention, although others could be talked about, was dandelion, which was an important food as well as medicine, and that was brought very much and planted very much intentionally by European settlers. That was not considered a weed. That was not considered a problem. That was an important and intentional act. So, you know, this was still the medicine of the time, and everyone depended on herbs of all sorts. And they both the ones they brought with them, and they were very avid about learning what plants awaited them in North America. And some of that was transmitted by the people that were here, which will be talked about next, but also some of it they learned with their own experimentation. I don't know if Mickey, do you want to talk about Philip Pendula?
Pendula, like Dandelion, you mentioned Dandelion, Metasweet is one of my polycrafts, and that was widely cultivated throughout the colonies, particularly in the Shaker colonies. I think they used it for beer, but there were certainly other actions that we can associate with that herb. And we know that Gerard wrote about that. We can quote him. It is a beautiful description of the uplifting action of Meadowsweet. And actually makes reference to a druidic tradition of strewing dried flowers through the house to purify the air. There are a number of plant families that come from Europe, the Malvaceae, Lamaceae, Rosaceae. We see these all over. And so, in addition to that, again, we'd like to talk about in his book, which we used, in this section, Herbalism Throughout the Ages, author Ralph Kerr observes that there's an interesting to note that there's a loose relationship of determinate quality between the physical environment and the cultural and economic development of the people who live in the land which provided for their use and enjoyment.
He goes on to point out in vivid detail that the large, wedge-shaped that included most of the Arctic region, northern Great Plains country in the United States, and the East Rocky Mountains extending south as Texas, game was abundant and natives lived predominantly by hunting. In a few more or less isolated areas, the people had developed semi-permanent campsites and were subsisting on cultivated herbs.
To summarize, Kerr postulates two possible explanations for the phenomena. The first is that game was relatively scarce in those particular areas, and in order to escape famine, they adopted the alternative of farming. Another idea, perhaps more feasible and tied to local folklore, of groups that claims land in the valleys of the Missouri and Yellowstone rivers, point to a legend that they'd been driven from some part of the country quote, many hundreds of great suns ago, probably by Iroquois intercessions. But in their eastern camp circles, they had subsisted partly by hunting, but also by cultivating herbal foods. And throughout the years, these foods habits persisted, reinforced by the division of labor between these tribes.
We see evidence of ritualistic rites celebrating wild harvests and plants, in addition to cultivating, particularly among tribes of the Northwest Coast, California, the Plateau region. Even in parts of the Northwest, Great Plains, and the Northern Prairie, where game was prevalent, agriculture was rapidly becoming dominant over hunting and fishing as time progressed.
Well, the practices and customs, both ancient and modern, are the earliest settlers in North America. Vary greatly, to a certain extent because of the hereditary environmental differences. The most consistent pattern that seems to appear to permeate both Paleo Indians and Edmonds is best expressed by considering two related factors.
Regardless of their origin or subsequent habitation in North America, the populations that settled there were fundamentally mystic-minded. That is, they valued ritualistic portrayal of their beliefs, customs, and ceremonies. From deeply religious to commonplace, from simple rites to those lasting many days, every ritual was based on the recognition of great power and the university of great medicine, or the Great Spirit. Although naturally, different tribes have individual names for their supreme being and lesser spirits who demonstrated that power.
So the second point is that in all ceremonies, various herbs and herbal medicines were used to demonstrate the emotions depicted by the particular event being celebrated, and selected primarily by their ability to relate to the desired outcome of the ceremony. plants and animals were personified in Native American belief systems, each with its own spirit. And the shaman is the social, to a certain extent, political director of tribal activities. But his chief function in all cases was the healing of disease. Among the various tribes, it was thought that diseases were caused by the displeasure of one or more spirits that controlled a long list of natural phenomena. And to get relief from those spirits, offerings were made, which typically consisted of herbal preparations either given to a patient internally or as a poultice, or burned as a sacrifice to the spirit. Despite the wide geographical range we see here, most tribes use similar formulations in their treatment of disease. And this includes application of leaves, stems, roots, mixing the herb combination with food or drink, and offering herbs to the spirit or spirits by burning were some of the methods used and shared by these groups. And we move forward, you know, to physiomedicalism. And Ari can talk briefly about physiomedicalism.
Physiomedicalism is a system of natural medicine that was developed during the early 19th century, and in a large part is based on the medical discoveries of a poor farmer named Samuel Thompson. Thompson is credited with bringing Native American herbs into prominence among rural American households. Unlike the physicians of the day, which favored the use of mercury and bloodletting, along with a crude understanding of human physiology, Thompson employed herbal medicines within a constitutional framework. The physiomedicalist that succeeded Thompson continued in his stead, refining Thompson's vitalist concepts into a sophisticated system of clinical practice that merged the evolving sciences of the day with herbal medicine. While this school of thought largely disappeared in America by the early part of the 20th century, it flourished in Britain and has served as the foundation for the medical herbalism in the United Kingdom.
The eclectics were a somewhat related historical group. They were founded by Worcester Beach in New England. And also in the 1900s, or excuse me, the mid-1800s. And he studied with a German doctor who was named Jacob Tibb, but this doctor used basically the local herbs in the New York area, in the New England area. And Worcester Beach was very influenced by this. He did end up going to regular medical school, but he was pretty appalled by the bloodletting and mercury and heavy metals that were being used, and really wanted to use an eclectic range of therapies, you know, predominantly herbs, but homeopathy and also some of the stronger medicines that were used in mainstream medicine. He tried to start his own school and was strongly blocked by the mainstream medical profession, but did eventually end up founding or working with Worthington College in Ohio to start a school and a publication. He actually didn't like Thompson. He thought he was anti-intellectual, and so the eclectics and the Thompsonians and physiomedicalists did not get along, which was unfortunate because they clearly had far more in common than they had different. Many other famous eclectics are, I think, well known today because of herbalist Michael Moore's heroic efforts to scan and make those available, as well as by the Eclectic Institute's republications of them, John King and Harvey Wicks Felter, Finley Ellingwood, among many others. So this school has died out, but one of their famous institutions, the Lloyd Library, still exists in Cincinnati, Ohio, and is one of the largest libraries of herbal information in the world, and certainly the largest about eclectic medicine. And this had a strong influence on modern herbalists, because these were practitioners who were working at a very high level in terms of the degree of sickness they were working with and just how many patients they sought out. However, distinctive was their tendency to use simples and not to use formulas, and that was somewhat distinct from the physiomedicalists, among other, you know, somewhat distinct things. But they did last until the 1930s. That was when the last sort of eclectic practitioners were in wide circulation.
So we see, you know, as Dr. Arnold takes us up to the 1930s, obviously, the United States gets involved in various foreign affairs, and this shapes the landscape of American society in a very dominant way for a number of decades. We're specifically pointing to China to point out that after World War II, when the People's Republic of China was established, trade relations are pretty minimal to non-existent. It's not until Nixon goes to China in the early 70s that trade relations with China begin to open up.
Although there was an influence of Chinese medicine before that, which, because there were people that came from China to the United States, and a famous example of that was with the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, which was particularly in the West done by a lot of Chinese immigrant labor. And there is a famous place in John Day, Oregon, which is a little town in northeastern Oregon, and there's the Kam Wa Chung Herb Company, which was a Chinese herbal grocery and clinic. And it was believed to have been built around 1866. It was basically sort of the hub of the Chinese community in that area. It eventually closed, but was protected and eventually became owned by the city and is open today as a museum. Fantastically, when they kind of reopened it, everything was perfectly preserved. The herbs were there exactly as they had been about 100 years before. So this is an example of how, there were subcultures in the United States, of course, where herbal medicine from around the world was being used, and this surely had to have had influence on other people around. But it was pretty clearly in the 70s and in the 80s when Chinese medicine started to really flourish and interest in Chinese herbs started to flourish, and that led to quite an explosion that we'll talk about next.
As best as we can tell, this group of individuals and their contemporaries are largely responsible for the widespread opportunities to practice many of the manifestations of herbalism that exist in America today. Among this group, gathered at Brighton Bush Hot Springs in Oregon, many of you will recognize authors and researchers, apothecaries, and clinicians. Some of you will recognize cherished teachers and mentors, and a few of you very well may be in this picture.
This eclectic group of bold individuals, inspired by the, say, uninhibited passion of the counterculture social currents that exploded in the 60s and 70s, and united in their respect and awe of the ancient and continuously evolving relationship between plants and humans, really laid the foundation for our modern understanding of herbalism in America with their direct firsthand experiences.
In 1989, in the warm waters in the hills of Oregon, the American Herbalist Guild was born. There should be little doubt that the philosophy and mission of this group, not to mention its professional members, have fundamentally shaped the course of the modern American herbalist.
We see here the mission of the American Herbalist Guild laid out in its details, and we've highlighted two points here. The first, establishing the American Herbalist Guild professional membership as a recognizable standard of the competency in botanical medicine. And second, promote cooperation between herbal practitioners and other healthcare providers, integrating herbalism into the community healthcare. The AHG becomes the first organized body in recent history that registers professional herbalists. Despite the widely inclusive rhetoric used to define the group's theoretical mission and scope, which we see here, which illustrates many facets of herbalism that fall under what we can now jointly understand as the traditional purview of the apothecary. The mission and scope in praxis is limited to only registering professional herbalists who maintain a clinical practice. Let us remind ourselves of the state of medicine in Europe during the 19th century and the struggles of the Worshipful Society of Apothecaries with the College of Physicians to set the precedent for all plant-based medical professionals and organizations to follow. Now, it's important to note that the first generation of herbalists who forged these standards of clinically based herbal practice for us later generations did not intentionally disconnect the clinician and the apothecary in the way that the physicians intentionally destroyed the apothecaries. Let me remind you that in medieval Europe, the apothecaries were individuals selling wine, spices, and herbs. They prepared and sold medicines to physicians and directly to patients. In addition, they offered medical advice and other products. I submit to you that many of the folks that founded the AHG and exist today as professional members were and are apothecaries.
In the current settings, it's impossible for one to be all of these things. Need for cooperative division of labor in order to facilitate a consistently positive effect on an individual's well-being.
Modern social forces are encouraging the herbal community to represent the gloriously dynamic force that manifests as herbal medicine in communities throughout America. We can rely on our proven capacity to work as an organized profession, or we could create a totally new model. Either way, shoots from the first sown seeds of inspiration are beginning to find strength as mature trees in an increasingly threatened forest. In the face of tightening federal regulations, we need to call on the many different types of herbalists to work together in order to preserve the art and mystery of our craft with modern tools and techniques. To ensure that this act is not merely one of self-preservation and continues to positively impact those that come after ourselves, we should encourage the development of a dynamic community of herbalists where the professional scope of one's job is secondary to a principal dedication to a life working with medicinal plants.
Any comments, Eric?
I think you said it.
So, moving into our communal and professional future, our clinical and community-based herbalists need to be supported and protected by medicine makers, analytical scientists, and regulatory professionals. On one hand, if we don't claim our traditions and methods, the modern-day equivalent of Europe's College of Physicians, the FDA, may still act the part of their historical predecessor and slowly dismantle the rights of the apothecary to practice their ancient craft, much to the detriment of our modern preventative healthcare systems that rely on herbs as a large part of their therapeutic protocols.
I mean, we're seeing evidence of this. I have a friend in Oregon that runs an herb shop that has apothecary in the name, and she has received letters from the state of Oregon claiming that the term apothecary is the responsibility or is the sole ownership of the pharmacist and is therefore unlawful for her to use.
If you go on the FDA website and review recent enforcement activities, oftentimes now we'll find herbal companies being subject to enforcement from CDER, which is the drug regulatory portion of the FDA. We, of course, should be regulated as food as things stand. A really common point of regulation right now is the presence of what is considered pharmaceutical compounds in herbs. Many times these pharmaceutical compounds, well, mostly they do come from the herbs. They're supposed to be there. Seeing these enforcement activities shows that we may be seeing a future where our country wants to regulate herbs as drugs And that, of course, opens a whole new can of worms.
And on the other hand, by only extolling one aspect, primarily extolling one aspect of professional herbal medicine, historically an aspect that characterizes the tendencies of the College of Physicians more than the Apothecary's Guild, we're really only offering our students lip service with regards to achieving professional success as an herbalist outside of the clinic. By expanding our self-identity, we can encourage the coming generations of herbalists to branch out into other areas of our own ancient profession that are fundamental to our continued existence rather than those created in terms of medical history by rather young groups like the modern pharmaceutical industry and governing regulatory agencies. It will be a sad day when the apothecary has little employ outside of Bayer or Ginkgo or Pfizer. The point Ari makes about patented chemical compounds that are naturally occurring in plants is an important one, and I urge all of you that do compound your own medicines to consider the ramifications of that for you and your personal and professional practice.
I think it's also notable that any of you talk to the average herbalist today that a lot of them do actually make at least some of their own medicine, but it's kind of astonishing how within our own circles we pay so little attention to that. Or it's, if you just look at a conference, whether it's the guilds conferences or any other of the herbal conferences, there's so little about medicine making. There's tidbits in people's talks, but there's not usually a track devoted to that or really much effort put into that. And it's unfortunate because I think there's a lot of interest, and I think that is overlooking a very critical part of the equation, let alone regulatory issues, although there has been growing interest in that, or even I think less recognizes the need for us to develop our analytical skills and to claim that so that the conventional people are not the only ones publishing research about herbs. We all complain, oh, that study wasn't done right. They didn't know the traditional use. Well, we do. We're the ones that have to step up and say, we're going to do the science. We're going to talk about these herbs. We're going to show you how to do it right and claim that territory instead of skulking in the back and just doing our own little thing in our own little corner. We've got to get out there and claim the public space. This is, and medicine making is one aspect of that, but so is research, so is the need for analytical chemistry, the need for regulatory interactions, all those things.
Well, the need for the wildcrafter is one that we haven't touched on yet. I mean, there's the significance of retaining access to these resources, but we also want to protect that access into the future, and we don't want to encourage strip crafting as I've heard it being encouraged in the personal use or the commercial use of herbs. And clearly, herbs are diversifying as the nutraceutical industry grows. So this is a craft that is clearly a very very valued part of what we do, both in and out of the clinic, and it's important to recognize that's its significance to our modern day situation.
And as we hear terms such as nutraceutical, these analytical terms that get used with herbs, the interest of greater industry in herbal medicine, we do see PhDs and research scientists, analytical methods, regulatory attention being paid to these herbs, and we do see people moving into these professions, but they're not necessarily herbalists. I feel like we see very few herbalists, or at least people that start out on the path from an interest in herbs, end up in these professions, and we're going to be in a much better position in future with better information and better protected if we have some of our own people, our new up-and-coming herbalists, encouraged to go into these fields and feel like they as we mentioned earlier, have other viable ways to practice their craft, as clinic doesn't speak to all of us.
So we've posted here, you know, we'd like to open this up for questions, comments, from any of the audience members that are currently tuning in, or anyone currently listening to this in the future. And these are just some questions to start spurring that dialogue. Currently, as Ari just mentioned, for clinicians, there's a variety of ways to practice the craft of clinical medicine. You know, there's naturopathy, as Dr. Yarnell's featured. There's acupuncture, the registered herbalist, registered nurses, MDs. So how do the other facets of herbalism receive professional recognition?
How do we define what these other facets of herbalism are? How inclusive should we be? What should the lines be between an analytical chemist and a drug or herb discovery, compound discovery person?
And there are, we mentioned, obviously the AHG as one existing organization, but presently there are a number of organizations that are involved with the herbal community and represent various manifestations of the herbal community. Again, are there any ways in which other facets of herbalism receive professional recognition, for example?
So at this point, we would like to open the floor to some of the attendees who are listening. The idea behind this was very much a platform to present what we feel is a common thread among herbalists right now, interested in seeing recognition as herbalists for people that practice outside of the clinic. To those support herbalists, the ones that really help to make our clinician shine, help the information that they know is true and valid come through to their patients by providing excellent, clean, well-harvest herbs that have been grown where they like to be and are potent, by making the medicines that are exemplary of our craft, by protecting the medicines to make sure that they can reach our clinicians and our patients.
And we've spoken about a lot of history today. But we very simply laid out in our introduction the boundaries from seed to safe use. Again, and this is what we traditionally identify as the purview of the apothecary. And we can identify a lot of present-day roles within the motto from seed to safe use. Again, starting with those that grow or wild harvest medicinal herbs, again, are critical to a high-quality, effective remedy in the clinic. This really represents the most traditional, the most vibrant connection to our traditional roots in the modern day herbalists. These are people that spend lots of time out in the woods. They're learning from plants, that very, very old relationship that we have that we all recognize is a valid way to learn and experience this craft. On the other end of that, we have the, as Ari and Eric spoke about, the analytical herbalist that run QA/QC tests, testing our supplements for anaerobic and aerobic bacteria, yeast and mold, E. coli, uncovering chemical constituents, publishing, researchers, writers. As Dr. Yarnell said, really establishing a body of information that is based on our direct firsthand experience as a community.
Owning our industry, rather than letting the pharmaceutical industry decide where we'll be in 20 years.
In the middle, forging the bridge between somewhat traditional and somewhat modern is the medicine maker who meets raw materials, whether dried or fresh, and uses modern techniques, technologies, to produce medicines that are sometimes very, very personal, as is the tradition in the herbal healing community, to treat the individual patient with an individual remedy. But sometimes we make medicines for our communities on a larger scale with the gifts around us, God's manifestations, as the Muslims call them. So we offer these up to you to consider, and we urge you to contact us with thoughts, questions, comments, and we hope you all enjoy this story.
And this PowerPoint presentation should be made available for anybody that wants a copy. And we, of course, have our references listed for you so you can find out more about our exciting history and where we think herbalism might be going in the future and apothecary.
We thank you all that took some time to spend time with us this evening. And we hope that it was an enlightening moment. And we look forward to hearing your thoughts and moving forward in the future. Good night, all.
Thank you so much.